Please silence all electronic devices.
Representatives Brawley, Sain, Hastings, Martin, even Setzer, and Soka are recognized.
So the bottom line is, folks, there are a lot of bad people out there.
I'm Elizabeth Dole, and I approve this message.
You're fired!
You know, the guy that used to sit in this chair had a saying, if you think everybody's good, you ain't met everybody.
Any further discussion or debate?
From the Rayburn office building on Capitol Hill, this is the WUNC Politics Podcast. Glad to have you along. Today we're chatting with Democrat David Price, a 15-term member of the U.S. House. Congressman, a busy week in Washington. Thanks for spending some time and chatting with us.
Thank you. Good to be with you. And it was a busy week in the district also because my colleague Adam Schiff from California, who is newly known. I've known him a long time, but he's now a household word because of his role in this Russia investigation. He was in the district at the first of the week, gave a great lecture over at Duke, and otherwise visited around the district. So we came back Tuesday and have been going at it here since then.
Let's start with Monday, I guess. The first round of indictments came. What was your initial reaction to the news that we got on Monday? A couple of indictments, a guilty plea. And in this ongoing probe into Russia?
Well, by the time it happened, it wasn't a total surprise, although the exact nature of the indictments was uncertain. I think this is getting pretty close to home. I think the president's reactions indicate that. He gives every indication of being cornered and lashing out. And But the fact is, this investigation is very, very serious. It must go on. It will go on. I think we have a very credible chief investigator, and we'll see where this leads. But it seems to suggest, at a minimum, that there was plenty of Russian interference in the election, and plenty of Russian attempts to get direct access to the Trump team.
There are diverging philosophies on this, but I heard from plenty of folks this week that said, well, they don't have Trump. You know, if they were going to get him, they would have got him by now. And others said, let's tap the brakes. This is how federal investigations and prosecutions work. This was the first wave. And if this was the first wave, holy cow, what could wave two and three have in store? How did you see it?
I think this is the first wave, and I have no idea where it's going to lead or how far it will go. Or whether the president himself will be implicated. Have no idea what the Russians may have on him. There does seem to be a likelihood they have something. And there's certainly a lot of evidence that Trump, of all the people in all the leaders in the world, most of whom he's condemned at one time or another, as far as I know, he's never laid a glove on Putin. And that's very strange. So there are questions, and they need to be answered. In the meantime, the presidency is not going well in terms of the kind of signals we're sending around the world, the shaky commitment to our basic alliances, the way the president, I particularly am sensitive to the way the president is trying to have it both ways on a bunch of critical issues and throwing the issue to the Congress in the end. There are three times recently where that's happened. One, on health care, he pulls out these subsidies, which is an act of pure sabotage for the Affordable Care Act. But then he essentially says to Congress, it's up to you whether you stabilize this market or not. He falsifies, I think, he falsely refuses to certify Iran's compliance with the nuclear deal. But then there too, he says, "Well, Congress, you're the ones who will do something to abrogate the deal if we move to that take that step." And then finally, the Dreamers, the young people who came here as children, who need to be their status needs to be legalized, and they need to stay in this country. That's just the bottom line. And the president said, well, no, that's going to run out in 6 months. But by the way, Congress, you have 6 months to fix it. So as if it wasn't enough to have the budget closing in on us, and the lights go out in this government on December 9th. Here we are, into the fiscal year, without a budget, And here we are struggling to get the numbers where we can write our 12 appropriations bills and function as a government. The president's been absolutely no help in that. And now he throws all these other things in our lap. It is just the biggest mess I've ever seen. And I'm not quite sure how we navigate through it, but we've got to find a way.
So I was going to ask you about, you know, the craziest times you've seen during your time as a House member, going back 30 years. I was going to ask you about Corker and McCain and Flake, and we'll get to that. And then I was going to ask you about tax reform. But looking at all those things and just combining them for the moment, it's chaos. And it's chaos from afar. It's chaos when you're here. We'll get to those three things I just mentioned, but I'm going to try to roll it into one question, which is, has chaos become the accepted norm for you? I mean, there's a whole lot going on.
We're in a situation of perpetual chaos, and you ask, has that become the accepted norm? No, never, never, never. This cannot ever be accepted as normal. But has it become the standard mode of operation for the Trump presidency? Absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, there's debate occasionally about how deliberate all this is. Is he someone who uses chaos to his own advantage? I suppose he does have a history of doing that, but this is dangerous for the country and for him too. I mean, really, to be a credible president, to lead the way a president needs to lead, to forfeit even the basic things a president does of reassuring a nation in times of division, in times of crisis. One's tempted to say it's a failed presidency already. And I must say that watching Donald Trump in operation, the notion that he would rise to the occasion has slipped farther and farther away. I'm not sure he's capable of being presidential in the sense we normally would understand that.
And you stop me at any point, because I'm certainly not a history person, not a history major. Your tenure has covered some pretty big moments in history. You know, we had the impeachment of a president. There were weapons of mass destruction that never were, a war that you were opposed to from pretty early on. There was the Abu Ghraib prison scandal. How does, specifically this week, not looking at the whole Trump presidency, but we have indictments. I mean, that was, I think, the biggest historical, perhaps, takeaway from this week. But where does this week stack up with so many others that you've had here on the Hill?
I think in terms of a comparable scandal or a comparable case of possible presidential malfeasance, this stacks up pretty seriously. In many ways, it does resemble the Watergate episode. In fact, it's more serious than that in terms of the violations we're talking about. Watergate was a third-rate burglary. This is a major foreign adversary undermining our democracy, manipulating a given election, but beyond that, much broader goals of undermining our democracy along with other Western democracies. This is about as important as it gets. And our investigation to get to the bottom of it is about as important as it gets. The president has yet to even acknowledge that this interference went on, let alone showing any support for the investigation. So without prejudging his own personal culpability, and I don't know where the investigation is going to lead exactly in that regard, it seems at a minimum that his campaign team was actively solicited, that in some cases they responded positively to Russian overtures, that the upper levels of the campaign at various times were populated by people who were taking millions upon millions of dollars from foreign sources, and in most cases didn't reveal that we have yet to hear about General Flynn, but we know about Manafort, and it's pretty serious. So yes, I think this stacks up as a major scandal. And really a major crisis for the country. I think we need to see this investigation through to the end. I also think, in terms of a second problem area, we need to be very, very vigilant about the unprecedented conflicts of interest that are stacking up. I'm not quite sure what the tipping point is there, but the fitness of this president is a major question. We need to just make sure we have all the facts.
So there are plenty of folks, obviously, the entire Democratic Party, who is speaking out against this president. On the Republican side, as I draw a line between Senators Corker, McCain, and Flake, can't help but notice that, barring something significantly unforeseen, none of those three senators will be here in 2019, in a year and a half. What's your level of confidence that a Republican member of the House or the Senate, not one of those three, but someone who's going to be here for the foreseeable future, is going to take on the president? Who might that be?
I don't know who it might be, but I do think it will happen.
Why?
Because I think the investigation is going to continue. I think the facts are going to be damning. And I'm not sure how far they will go in terms of implicating the president personally. But I think Republicans are going to face a pretty severe test as to where their loyalties lie and how far they're willing to go defending this president. And I, of course, don't know more than that. We just have to see how things unfold. I do have a lot of admiration for the speech that Jeff Flake gave on the floor of the Senate. That in particular, I think, was a cry of the heart. I know Jeff pretty well, and I wouldn't say agreed with him on too much in the way of policy issues, but I do think he's a man of conscience and a man of integrity, and I do think that was a speech that was from his heart. And it is something that you would think every member would listen to and would search their own heart for what their limits are of tolerating the behavior of the sort we see in the president and what they take their patriotic duty to be. Let me say one thing though about the kind of generalization that's sometimes made that nobody's done anything. It is true that virtually every member of the House and Senate, and that includes all but just a handful of Republicans, we voted back before the summer recess to deny the president the ability to waive the sanctions on Russia. That's important. There was this bill that increased the, it dealt with North Korea, Iran, and Russia, but the really critical part was continuing the sanctions on Russia, enhancing them in certain respects, sanctions that have to do with the bad behavior in Ukraine and with the bad behavior in our election. And we made the collective decision that while you would normally give a president the ability to waive those sanctions, and ordinarily you would say a president should have that flexibility. Not this president, not the Russia sanctions. So we voted that way, and that did include the Republicans. And then the Republicans in the Senate did something else that was interesting. They joined with Democrats and refused to formally adjourn the Senate. Why did they do that? Because they did not want to open the possibility of recess appointments by this president, and that might include something in the case of the chief prosecutor, Robert Mueller.
Plenty of fractures within the Republican Party on display. Some of the divides within the Democratic Party bubbled up again this week. There was, you're probably aware, there was this piece written by Donna Brazile today in Politico just about the funding of the Democratic Party and the challenges of Hillary's candidacy. More specifically, more broadly, what do you see as the biggest fracture or the biggest threats to your party right now? And second part of the question is, who is a figure that your party can coalesce around moving through 2018, 2020, and perhaps beyond?
The question of leadership in our party is one that we all are not only aware of, but actively talking, thinking about, working on. We are in a situation we didn't think we'd be in. We thought we would have a Democratic president and maybe a Democratic Senate, and that we would, in due course, of course, have other leaders emerge. But the fact that we do have this leadership vacuum has added urgency to that. I wouldn't deny that. But I also have some confidence that among our elected officials, among people in other walks of life, maybe, you know, there's plenty of leadership potential in our party, and I'm counseling a certain patience about that right now. I think there's going to be plenty of time to have leaders emerge and kind of test the waters and us to evaluate them. In the meantime, let's not take our eye off the ball. We have a, I'd say not just an opportunity, but an obligation to win the U.S. House of Representatives in 2018. We need 24 seats. I think we know where those seats are. And I want to pursue that goal in a single-minded way and leave some of these questions about 2020 and the top leadership of the party who might be considered viable for this or that. We don't need to settle all that right now. In fact, we have every reason to put first things first. And for me, that involves winning the House of Representatives. Why is that important? Because it will be a bastion of resistance when that's needed to this president, but it will also be a way for us as Democrats to turn toward a positive agenda, and I'd say that's our main challenge right now, not divisions. We all know about Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton and the primary campaign and the fact that people still have some loyalties, that we have some issue differences. Any vital active party is going to have those differences. Those don't worry me. What worries me though is if we're perceived as only an opposition party, as a party that does not have a full positive agenda. I think that agenda is right there for us to articulate. We first of all need to reclaim our mantle as the party of working Americans, the party of aspiring Americans, aspiring to the American dream, aspiring to have a better life for our children, aspiring to move our country forward, to widen opportunity, and we don't just mouth those as platitudes. We have ways to get there in terms of a healthy pace of economic growth, a fair tax system, education and training that makes people eligible for good jobs, and on and on. There's an agenda there. I do not think, for whatever reason, I do not think it was fully articulated or certainly fully heard in the 2016 election. That cannot happen again. That cannot happen again. We have a major challenge as a party to let the American people know how much we care and how hard we're going to work to make life better for our whole country.
Give me two or three campaign issues that the Democrats need to have in 2018 to get those 24 or more seats to take back the House.
We have to stand firm for a kind of economic growth that makes our country more prosperous, but also that makes prosperous more widely shared and more widely available. How do we do that? Well, the Republicans are about to take us in the wrong direction with a top-heavy tax plan, which is going to basically add to the inequality in this society and also add to our national deficit and debt in a damaging way. So what would we do differently? We would we too would alter the tax code, but we'd alter it in a way that promotes home ownership, that promotes education, that promotes middle class advancement, and that makes sure that the wealthiest people in this society are paying their fair share, and that we are paying our way as a country. We're not just adding to the debt for future generations. So I'd say that area of economic inequality and broadening opportunity is important as an underlying theme, and it does have implications for the tax code. It also has more positive implications for the way we the way we support education in this country. That's a major issue in North Carolina, and it's a major issue nationally. Are we still a country committed to that that crown jewel of public education that has made us has done so much for us for so long? Excellent public education, accessible public education, closing that achievement gap that leaves some of our kids falling short with respect to educational promise. Investing those community colleges, understanding those first 2 years past high school are the key to job to so many jobs that we need to fill. Investing in research. Goodness knows we know about that in our part of North Carolina. Research, spinoffs, entrepreneurship. There's an economic centered agenda that focuses on the middle class and those who aspire to the middle class that I think is key to what our party stands for, and I think we have lots of good ideas about how to help our country get there, and I want to see those ideas articulated very forcefully.
If Democrats take back the House, does Nancy Pelosi get another term as Speaker, or is it time for a new Speaker of the House on the Democratic side?
I think Democrats will take back the House, and I do think that that effort, of course, right this minute, is being led by our current trio of leaders, Nancy Pelosi, Steny Hoyer, and Jim Clyburn, all of whom have done a credible job. And they're kind of complementary in the appeals they have, the constituents they have, and so they're working as a team. I would think that if we win the House back, that those leaders who are all in their mid-70s and, not going to be here forever, those leaders will make decisions that they feel they need to make about whether they will seek leadership in the new Congress. I do not know what those decisions will look like. I think we will see. We're already seeing really a new generation of leaders coming on in the House. It's not clear who's first among equals right now, exactly who one would bet on, but I think we've got a good bench, as they say, and that in due course you'll see that kind of generational change. I think the whole calculus has been thrown off by the Trump victory, and we just have to acknowledge that. We didn't see this coming. Nancy Pelosi herself has said that she had Hillary Clinton won the presidency, and she probably would not be running again herself. So this is a time of great challenge for our party and for our leadership. A lot of people deciding this is not the time to walk away. But by the same token, there is a period of uncertainty here where new leaders will emerge. And I'm talking now about people who might aspire to the presidency. I'm talking also about House and Senate leaders. And that's, I'm at ease with that. I think we got good, strong people. Let's go at it. Let's figure out who has good ideas, who has the capacity to lead. I'm not afraid of a little competition, a little uncertainty. We'll live with that. We're going to end up, I think, winning the House back in 2018 and being in a very strong position going forward.
13 House seats from North Carolina, 10 Republican and 3 Democratic representatives at this moment. Which seat do you think is the most likely to flip, and why?
That's a very high-risk question for you to ask and me to answer, because we know how these things can change, and we also know that we have about the most gerrymandered state in the country. So these districts in North Carolina, there are 3 that have been packed with the Democrats, including mine. But that was not done as a favor to me. It was done to make all the districts around the 4th district Republican. And of course, that's pretty much the way it's turned out. So we're an evenly divided state. We have 10 Republican and 3 Democratic House members. The Republican districts are very skillfully drawn. And the Republican members tend to win by 50-some percent. or more. But 50-some percent is not, it can be overcome under the right circumstances. They've erected the barricades pretty high, but the waves might just well wash over those barricades, and I think they will.
So you think some are vulnerable?
I think some are vulnerable. I think we have some very promising candidates already emerging. I'll name one who is who's been in the news. It's no secret that he's running a very vigorous campaign. Dan McCready in the 9th district is looking very, very strong. But I think there'll be others like him. And these districts in North Carolina, as I say, they were skillfully gerrymandered. They knew what they were doing. But they maybe got a little too clever. And some of these districts are within reach in an election year that where there's a wave election or something like it, and I really think that's likely what we're looking at. And so you got to look for the right combination of a good, vigorous candidate, an incumbent who may stumble, and a district that, while difficult, is not totally out of reach.
Democrat David Price is the guest here on the WUNC Politics Podcast. His carefully crafted congressional district includes Chapel Hill, Durham, parts of Cary as well. Congressman, I'm going to tick off a few more rapid-fire questions if you want to play along, just because I'm looking at time and I want to be cognizant of that. Plane, train, or car, what's the worst way to get into and out of D.C.?
That is, if you're talking getting in and out of D.C. from our part of North Carolina, you ask about as impossible a question as you could, which you probably know in asking it, because it's not much fun these days traveling by any of those modes. Driving used to be something you could, if you picked the right time of day, you could zip in and out 4 1/4, I figured. Now you're lucky to get down through Fredericksburg without a major traffic jam. The train is going to be the way ultimately to go. I'm convinced of that. But unfortunately, the train now snakes around through a bunch of towns that put some hours on that trip. So it's not as fast as it should be to be competitive. And then our plane, we're lucky to have Delta and American serving the district. So I should say that, and I'm a frequent customer in both of those airlines. But you know, there are just too many delays, too many mechanical problems, too much hassle out at gate 35X, if you know what I mean, the gate where you have to take the bus out on the tarmac. We need better service in all three modes, and we're working on it. That's one reason I'm very happy to be on the Transportation Appropriations Subcommittee, because I've always thought that that transportation work was absolutely vital to where we need to go in North Carolina.
Favorite breakfast spot in D.C.
Oh, I don't go to breakfast spots in D.C. I have a group I chair called the Democratic Budget Group. It's a discussion group. It meets every Wednesday morning. It features coffee and stale donuts. That's about what I live on that day of the week, and then other times we have a little breakfast at caucuses. But I'm afraid I'm not a connoisseur of good breakfasts around Washington.
Fair enough. David Price, also the name of a famous baseball pitcher, a lefty, was with the Rays for a while, now with the Red Sox. Do you ever get, and how often do you get confused with the considerably younger pitcher?
Not very often. I should be so lucky, I suppose. He was in Durham a while.
That's right.
And he was in Durham actually only part of a season, and we apparently got a kick out of sharing a name. So I was set to meet him over at the Durham Bulls Park, and then he was out of there before we could pull that off. But no, the guy I got confused with, believe it or not, is Tom Price, late unlamented Secretary of Health and Human Services, who we didn't have much in common politically, but we did share a name and got a lot of each other's mail.
Last podcast that you listened to? Or am I just hitting on all the things you don't do? No breakfast, no podcasts, no David Price.
Well, I let's see. What did what I heard some I heard some of the podcast that came out of Adam Schiff's visit. We were listening to that. I don't have a very interesting answer there, I'm afraid, though.
You, I believe, celebrated birthday 77 in August. Is that right?
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Are you definitively running again in 2018? Is that something you're still thinking about?
No, I'm definitively running again in 2018, and we basically kicked off the campaign with the event where Adam Schiff was my special guest. I'm very grateful for that, and we're off and running.
Handicap for you, and I think I would have been there if I wasn't here on Monday afternoon. We've seen failed attempts to repeal the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare. There hasn't been a whole lot that has happened here with Republican majorities in both chambers across the last 9 months. Handicap for me on this early forecast that I'm looking for on tax reform. Is this something that's viably going to happen before we get into primary season, or is this just another shiny policy object?
I wish my crystal ball was better. If there's anything the Republicans want the public to think they stand for, it's cutting taxes. It sometimes seems like about the only thing that unifies them, and they have rolled out, of course, today their plan for I started to say tax reform. There really isn't much reform in this package. There really isn't. If by tax reform you mean cleaning up the code, cleaning up the loopholes, cleaning up the tax preferences, rationalizing the code, and then as a result of that, being able to lower rates. You know, that's a proposition most of us would accept in the abstract. But and there also needs to be attention paid to overall revenue levels, since we're running up such a deficit and debt that we're jeopardizing our fiscal future. So there's plenty of reason to be looking critically at the tax code, but I don't think this qualifies as reform, and I think the few elements in it that might are going to be subject to a lot of political flack. So my best prediction would be you might get a tax cut out of these crews. You will not get tax reform, and I think even the tax cut part is. You know, it's contingent on Republicans basically deciding that they're willing to blow a hole in the deficit for the sake of a political win. And some of them appear to be willing to do that. You know, deficits matter only when there's a Democratic president, apparently. So I don't know the answer to your question, but they're desperate to deliver a win here after other efforts have failed, such as health care changes. And I believe they're going to bend every effort to pass something, but it really probably won't qualify as serious reform.
I have used up my time, but I want to at least give you the floor. There are several things we haven't talked about, and I'm happy to cut this out if you've got to go somewhere. But whether it's FCC or DREAM Act legislation or other, what else is top of mind that you want to spend some time talking about, if anything?
When I look at the challenges facing the country and the areas where the president has misstepped and Congress needs to be responsible, I think of the Iran nuclear agreement as an extremely important element of our country's foreign policy to get right. I mean, this is an extraordinary diplomatic achievement. It involves not just our country, but European partners, Russia, China. Just an extraordinary thing to get this done and to get Iran's nuclear capacity neutralized. Not just neutralized, but degraded. Now, Iran does lots of other things that we've got to work on. But there's not a one of those things, such as supporting Hezbollah or missile tests or whatever they're doing. There's not a one of those things that wouldn't be worse if they had a nuclear capacity. And I think everybody around President Trump knows this. They also know that Iran has, sure enough, abided by the nuclear agreement. And there are inspectors in there very intrusively every day verifying that. But Trump himself just has a thing about this. He talked about it on the campaign trail. He sees it as an Obama legacy, and he's done something very dangerous in refusing to certify Iran's compliance with that agreement. So if you ask me what is absolutely critical to get right in the next 2 months, I would say Congress needs to refrain from any kind of action that abrogates that agreement. And then, of course, the other major challenge facing Congress and facing the country is the budget. That's what everything else depends on, getting budgetary house in order. That requires bipartisan cooperation. It's not going to happen otherwise. And so here, too, we're going to have to somehow get past the polarization, get past the excesses of partisanship and act on the country's behalf. This has to pass. You can't keep the lights on in government unless you pass a budget. And we've kicked the can down the road to December 9th. By then, we need to have a bipartisan agreement that lets us write these appropriations bills, do the basic work of government, and the president needs to help with that, not impede it. And I'm going to do everything I can to make that to make that happen. And I realize it's a bipartisan task, but that's the way our country works. We have checks and balances. At the end of the day, we have to agree, and I'm going to do everything I can to promote a responsible budget so that we can do what our country needs to do, invest in our country for these future years.
Congressman, thank you for the time. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you.
And thanks, as always, for listening to the WUNC Politics Podcast. You can download on iTunes, Google Play, or Stitcher. Stay up to date throughout the week with political news at our website, wunc.org. For Congressman David Price, I'm Jeff Tiberi. Enjoy your weekend. Talk to you next week.